Though I have now two emotional people are talking about brain, the battle of brain and the heart. For sure, to us, it's the heart who is the winner. But we have to be honest that sometimes the heart would work as, it would get in the way of your improvement. Sometimes you love something so much, a journey, a major, a person, whatever. It can be anything, a home even that you want to buy. You love something so much that you would ignore all the faults that you see in them, in the things, I mean, or in the people. So in this way, you're going to get stuck in a situation where there's no improvement coming out of it. But then you keep in that problem, you keep up with that problem, you keep up participating in that thing, or you keep up repeating that mistake for many times just because you love that person, just because you love that thing, you love that decision that you're making. But if you listen to your mind, maybe you're going to get into a better conclusion.
So true. You know, for myself, I have this slogan that to the extent that my heart is controlling my mind, it's okay. Like, it's okay to know that the right decision is this, but you are going a little in a different way. But once my heart closes my eyes, at this point, I need to change.
Exactly. You see, there are many Islamic stories that we have in our heritage that tell us that it's not always the story of heart and mind. Like, you know, sometimes it's the whole purpose of your life. I always, whenever I'm coming to talk about the story of heart and mind, I just remember the battlefield of Karbala. Like, the people who participated in that fight and they came to support Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who were actually very few of men. But then all of them, what they did was not a mind sort of trade. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It's mind would never encourage you to get into a battle that you know.
Actually, the opposite will happen with the
exactly,
mind.
Exactly. The mind would tell you that, okay, this battle that you're entering has got no consequence, no benefits for you, has got no positive consequences.
Right.
But you get into that battle because you know that no matter what happens to you, at the end of the journey, God is there. Yeah. God is the one you're trading with. That's why you go there with your heart.
Yeah, exactly. And on the other side, when we look at the Islamic thoughts and teachings, whenever we are overwhelmed with the emotions and we do not know either to stay reluctant, not make any decisions, or go for one of the ways, we have many techniques that will help us and foster our decisions, that will help us to know either if we have to go for the mind or the thoughts and emotions.
Yeah, to know them, we go for a break and then we come back.
Sure.
I was too proud to see the truth and prostrate to you until I took the first step. That's when you opened the doors for me. Now, Allah, I realize what I was missing by being far from you.
So based on Islamic narrations, you have to make a balance between your heart and your mind.
Right.
Though it's very difficult, but you have to try to do that. In many occasions, what we have been encouraged to do is to actually trust our heart. Because I usually think that, well, this is my assessment, actually. This is the thing that I have got. In my theories and in my analysis, I get it this way, that heart is stronger than mind to
of
back you up
is.
In difficult situations.
Of course it is. It
like
gives
the heart, you know, just as I brought up the story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his followers, it's the heart that would, out of love, push you into doing something that based on the worldly criteria is not going to come any benefit out of it. It's only the heart. Like, you know, We have many stories that would tell you that you have to trust your heart as well as your mind. So based on the worldly criteria, we can put it this way, that you must obtain this balance between your heart and mind, but it's difficult, though try to keep it in mind that sometimes it is the heart that would push you into the much more adventurous way, but at the end of the day, when you get to the concluding point, it is the heart that would get you in the endings that are pretty much more beautiful.
Yeah, so true. And that emotion that is the driving force, when it is controlled, when it is to the extent that it can push us mm-hmm. in the better way, it's okay. But when we are overwhelmed and when we are pressurized by our emotions, in Islam we have many techniques, be it the pray. Simply just praying and having dua, talking.
Which is a sort of purification.
Exactly.
Even if you cry, you are bringing out all the negative energies inside of you, and then you try to seek help from God.
It's like you are sorting your emotions, finding the good ones, and then continuing your journey with mm-hmm. the emotions that are the driving forces of life.
Yeah, exactly. The meditation, they call it meditation, but in the Islamic heritage, we call it praying.
Pray.
Also, reading and reciting the Holy Book of Quran can help you so much to attain that balance between your heart and emotion. There are many people whom, when they get into a difficult situation, when they're stuck in a perplexing situation, they seek refuge in Holy Book of Quran. And when they recite different verses of this book, they can feel that God is actually helping them sort everything out.
So true. Also asking for advice mm-hmm. from the Muslim scholars available.
Exactly, yeah.
And this way we can get in touch with them. We can just communicate mm-hmm. and get the ideas, the things that we need in order to find the correct way when we are in the battle of the mind mm-hmm. and the heart.
You know, it's just as I said before, it's not much about the story of heart and the mind. It's about what God wants us to do. Which one is the best choice I have to go for at this situation?
You can just look at Ahl al-Bayt, alayhim as-salam.
Exactly.
You can see the way they were choosing their ways and the way they were sacrificing the mind and this worldly materials.
Yeah, like Sayyidah Zainab, salamullah alayha, when she's asked what you're seeing, what you saw, and then she said, I saw nothing but the beauty. It is
right.
not the mind telling you this. It's the heart. It's a mindful heart actually telling you this, because she knows where she's going. She knows what happened to them. She knows everything behind the curtains. That's why what she sees is nothing but the beauty.
Yeah, and what she had seen is nothing that the mind will label as beauty.
Exactly. But it needs a mindful heart, as I just
told
you.
Of course.
So this was all for today. I hope you have just enjoyed it. Until another session, I wish you happiness, health, and, of course, try to care more for your heart.
So until the next time, wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
On Monday, February 24th, Beirut's Kamil Shamoun Sports City Stadium became the site of a poignant farewell for the martyred leader of Hezbollah. Hundreds of thousands gathered within the stadium and its vicinity, with many traveling from southern Lebanon and the Bekaa Valley, some even walking long distances to reach Beirut in time for the ceremony. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the revered Secretary General of Hezbollah, emerged from the heart of southern Lebanon, with his journey steeped in the struggles of his community. Born in a poor neighborhood of East Beirut, he was acutely aware of the hardships faced by the Shia population from a young age. His family migrated to Beirut from a region long oppressed by Israeli forces, experiences that deeply influenced Nasrullah's identity as a fighter. Initially focused on addressing local issues, his role evolved into that of a significant leader on regional and global stages. In his early activism, Nasrullah did not position himself as a global thinker. Instead, he represented the Shia community of Lebanon. During his adolescence, he became involved with the Amal movement, where he embraced concepts of resistance and social justice inspired by Imam Musa Saad's teachings. Following Imam Musa Saad's mysterious abduction in Libya and the shift in Amal's leadership, many young activists, including Nasrullah, found themselves at odds with the movement's direction. This ideological divergence motivated them to establish an Islamic movement influenced by the principles of Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In 1982, amid the turmoil of the Lebanese civil war and the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon, Hezbollah was born, not as an international organization, but as a grassroots response to occupation and the violence endured by the Shia community. Hezbollah engaged in a dual struggle, fighting against Israeli forces and their Christian allies in the south, who were aligned with the South Lebanon Army, led by Antoine Lahad. This conflict intensified as the civil war evolved from clashes between extremist Christians and Palestinian supporters into a struggle involving various factions, further complicated by foreign interventions. While the Taif Agreement ultimately ended the 15-year civil conflict, Hezbollah faced new challenges, including the assassination of Sayyid Abbas Mousawi by Israeli forces merely 9 months after he assumed the role of Secretary General. When Nasrullah assumed leadership as a young figure, he dedicated himself to preventing the recurrence of civil war in Lebanon. He forged a strong alliance among Shia factions, which enabled Hezbollah to emerge as a dominant political and military force in both Lebanon and the wider region. After 18 years of struggle, sacrifice, and unwavering commitment, Hezbollah successfully liberated southern Lebanon from Israeli occupation in the year 2000. A pivotal moment in Nasrullah's leadership was his strategic decision to integrate Hezbollah into Lebanon's political framework. Unlike many militia groups that distanced themselves from formal institutions, he led Hezbollah to participate in the 1992 parliamentary elections, securing 12 seats through public votes. This political engagement, alongside the establishment of various service, educational, and cultural institutions, transformed Hezbollah from a guerrilla organization into a quasi-governmental entity. It provided essential services to the population, maintained an armed presence, and influenced decision-making in Beirut, Lebanon's capital. Although Nasrullah was a Shia leader, he positioned Hezbollah as a representative of all Lebanese, consistently advocating for national unity and fostering friendships among diverse communities in his speeches. This approach garnered Hezbollah significant support across Christian, Sunni, Shia, Druze, and Alawite populations, enhancing his political legitimacy. Hezbollah became the first Arab group to liberate its territory through resistance against Israel, inspiring resistance movements in the Palestinian territories and fueling a wave of intifadas. The Israeli withdrawal not only marked the liberation of Lebanese land, but also shattered the myth of Israeli army's invincibility. As Hezbollah's power and popularity surged, so too did the plots and conspiracies aimed at undermining its momentum. The 33-day war of 2006 began with extensive Israeli airstrikes across Lebanon. Yet Hezbollah employed effective guerrilla and defensive tactics that enabled them to resist effectively and inflict significant casualties on Israeli forces. This conflict displayed Hezbollah's military prowess on a global stage and compelled US and Israeli leaders who had been promoting the emergence of a new Middle East to promptly pursue ceasefire negotiations. Following the war, Hezbollah's popularity surged as many in Lebanon and across the Arab world viewed the group as a symbol of resistance against occupation. As terrorist groups emerged in Syria and Iraq, backed by global powers, Hezbollah deployed its forces to confront them, in tandem with the rest of the resistance axis. The group's involvement was not only to support Bashar al-Assad, but also to address a humanitarian crisis, seeking to aid the oppressed, even among non-Islamic sects in the region. Nasrallah's strategic decision was also aimed at preserving the vital Tehran-Baghdad-Damascus-Beirut corridor, often termed Iran's land bridge to the Mediterranean. Should this route be severed, Hezbollah would face a siege from enemy ground forces, greatly increasing the threat of terrorism spreading throughout the region. Hezbollah's participation in the Syrian conflict bolstered its military capabilities and enhanced operational experience, positioning the group as a critical player in regional dynamics and making the aspiration of liberating Al-Quds more attainable. Following Hamas's launch of Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Hezbollah reaffirmed its comprehensive support for the Palestinian people and entered the fray under Nasrallah's leadership. As the conflict evolved over the year, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu perceived himself as a defeated leader. He ordered a significant operation involving the detonation of 4,000 Hezbollah pagers, previously compromised during security operations held by Lebanese citizens linked to the resistance. Furthermore, Israeli military forces assassinated over 10 senior Hezbollah commanders during a meeting, marking a critical escalation. Just 3 days later, Netanyahu initiated a third war against Lebanon, unleashing extensive bombardment with American-made jets and munitions. The Secretary General of Hezbollah was deeply grieved by the loss of many of his most prominent commanders and over 1,000 Lebanese citizens who fell in the brutal conflicts. Despite this heartache, he remained resolute in Beirut's Dahiyeh, continuing to lead the resistance with unwavering determination. On the evening of September 27, 2024, from the United Nations headquarters in New York, Benjamin Netanyahu ordered a significant escalation in military action against Nasrallah, authorizing the deployment of more than 80 tons of bunker-busting bombs, double the amount anticipated in Israeli military assessments, to eliminate the Hezbollah leader. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, after 32 years of steadfast leadership, ultimately made the ultimate sacrifice, leaving behind a profound legacy of resistance for freedom-seeking people around the world. He famously declared, "Wherever you find us, under any stone, rubble, or the entrance of any Husseiniyah or mosque, kill us. But we, the Shias of Ali ibn Abi Talib, will never cease to support Palestine. His commitment to the cause and his enduring spirit continue to resonate with those who champion the fight for justice and liberation.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints with me, Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio are two special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sheikh Nur Muhammad. Sheikh Nur Muhammad, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
All right, there are so many questions and doubts about the concept of hijab, especially for the ladies. So what is the perfect form of hijab, and is covering the hair part of the hijab for women or not? Sheikh Nur Muhammad, let's start with you, brother. How does Islam introduce hijab for women for us? I mean, is there any clear picture given to us about the concept of hijab according to the Quran and the Hadith and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Obviously, yes. We have at least two verses in the Noble Quran explicitly, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, talking about the concept of hijab. And I'm really wondering that many people maybe they are not aware of these two verses, at least these two verses of Noble Quran, in chapter Ahzab and chapter Nur, and they are arguing about the concept of hijab. Inshallah, I will talk about these beautiful verses of Noble Quran.
That's right.
But prior to that, let me talk about a bit about the philosophy of hijab. Why this concept is important in Islamic law.
That's right.
You know that I think obviously nowadays, I think it's very clear that's why hijab is important in Islam. Mm-hmm. It's part of the Islamic laws. You know that in Islamic perspective, women cannot be considered as a sexual puppet.
Okay.
Or you may call it a sexual toy. Actually, woman has her own
dignity and honor,
dignity and personality, and Islam wanted to maintain this dignity.
That's right.
This is very important.
This is called the objectification process,
exactly.
Or we can say commodification of the women. That's
if you look at the social media, in any propaganda, unfortunately, in some propaganda, you find that they have been used the women as a tools, as sexual tools, in order to sell some kind of products.
All right.
Islam wanted to ban this, phenomenon. Wanted to give some kind of dignity and personality for the woman. When you talk to the woman, you should respect her. This is part of the, woman's rights. I think hijab is woman's rights.
That's right.
They have to maintain their personality, their dignity. And when you talk, you have to respect her. Okay, look at her personality, not look at her beauty only.
Okay.
This is very important.
So if we consider hijab as the women's rights, on that time, nobody is allowed to violate such a rights. We can say. And if a person, a lady herself, does not observe hijab, it means that she herself is violating the right, her own rights, isn't it?
Exactly. Okay. I don't know why some people, they want to talk in this very negatively about the concept of hijab.
Okay.
I'll talk about this issue more.
So in different cultures all around the world, we could see different forms of hijab for the ladies. But the major question is that, is covering the hair an obligatory part of hijab for the ladies according to Islam or not, Shaykh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, of course, absolutely. This is the part of the hijab that is, there is a consensus among all the different schools of Islam and sects of Islam that hair must be covered. Because in the Holy Quran, Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in the verse number 24, ayah number 31, says that, and tell the believing women to lower their gaze and guard their chastity and not to reveal their adornments except what normally appears. Let them draw their veils over their chests.
Uh-huh.
From this part, that
so Yudnia alayhin, veil the chest, it means from head to chest,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Okay. Yeah. From this part, Yudnina alayhinna min jalabibihinna, which says that draw their veils over their chests,
all right,
indicates that this hair scarf or khimar must cover the hair, okay, neck, and bosom.
That's right.
So this is what all Muslim sects,
right,
among Sunnis and Shias all agree, that this kind of hijab must be observed by the Muslim ladies and women.
And according to Arabic fiqh al-lugha, khimar is not a thin type of cloth.
Yes.
It's a kind of thick one, the other part of which cannot be seen easily.
Yeah, because there are some technical terms in the whole Quran.
Right.
One is, for example, khimar. Khimar is a head scarf that covers the head, neck, and and chest.
Yes.
And then jilbab. Jilbab is a kind of loose outer garment covering the entire body.
So it's
body.
Not tight.
It's
right.
The entire
it's loose
body,
one.
Yes.
That's right, okay.
And also we have abaya or chador that is, or even according to some of the sects, niqab.
That's right.
That should,
burqa,
actually, again,
that's
yes.
Right. Burqa,
yes.
That's right.
A full-length kind of cloak.
Yes.
So these are the things that it should covers cover all the entire body except those part of the body like face and hand
right.
That normally appears. So from these things we understand that in hijab, when we observe hijab, we should cover our hair.
Okay.
For the ladies.
The Western thinkers and the liberal capital world says that hijab is a type of limitation for the women. You are limiting the freedom of ladies. How do you answer this question, Sheikh Nur Muhammad?
I think those people who actually use, as I said, women, you know, as a sexual toy, they are limiting the woman, not the, you know, or any concept of the hijab.
Okay.
You know that actually, let me mention one point. We have different cultures.
Yes.
Okay. We are not talking about the cultures. Maybe in Indian culture, I don't know, in Pakistani culture, many other in different countries, they have their own covering. But what matters is to have the kind of Islamic covering, as my brother mentioned, in the at least two verses of Noble Quran, we have the concept of hijab or concept of kind of covering for the woman. But it can be different in different cultures.
Right.
Okay? We do not want to focus on, for example, one culture, Iranian culture, or, for example, different cultures of hijab. But after all, what is obligatory for women not to attract the sexual attention of the opposite gender?
Right.
This is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Not to walk in a way or cover in a way that attract the attention.
That's right.
You know, it's some kind of nudity, you know.
Right.
It attract the attention of the opposite gender.
Okay.
And it's kind of the lost culture.
That's right.
You know, this is important in Islam.
Unfortunately, the concept of hijab and covering itself somehow is deviated. I mean,
yeah, it's possible.
This hijab style or something like that. The ladies who we can see are in photo shoots or something like that with hijab.
Yeah.
We can see lots of cosmetics and the makeup on the face. And with hijab,
we can
say, again, we could see that. This is the kind of tabarruj, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
I mean, that a person might be showing off, a lady especially, through hijab. This is, again, a big sin, Sheikh.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. Yeah. I'm talking
That's
about
right.
this point. And,
right.
You know, what matters is to not to attract the attention of the opposite gender.
Opposite gender.
And
right.
actually, the concept of hijab is for the serenity of woman, you know, to have the very beautiful, I don't know, a very lovely, you know, family.
That's right.
To enjoy being with other people, you know, to act with other people.
Okay.
To maintain your family.
That's right.
It is very important.
All right.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
as most of the converts to Islam, especially the ladies, observe hijab to the full extent. I mean, if you look at those ladies who convert from the non-Islamic world to the Islamic one, their hijab is really complete and beautiful. I mean, and when you ask them why hijab in this world, they say because it gives you a kind of honor and it's kind of, we can say, dignity and respect. I mean, and the men, especially in the Western world, cannot get close to you as near, as private as they were before. So all in all, hijab is a kind of protection for the women and not exactly, a kind of limitation. But Sheikh Rouhani, is it possible that hijab be considered as a limit for some ladies when they are in the society? Is it good or bad? I mean, because nowadays in the modern world, the ladies are an inevitable part of a society. So can hijab really ban them from presence in some parts of the society?
Of course not. You know, when we talk about hijab, observing hijab, Islam is a religion of fitra or nature, because we believe that Islamic teachings and doctrines and rulings are completely compatible with our nature. As Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the creator of us, He knows our essence and our nature. Then all the rulings that we should observe Islamically, they are also completely compatible with this nature that we have. What does it mean? It means that if you now go and interview those ladies in the modern world,
yes,
who, for example, display themselves in the public,
yes,
or, for example, like co-workers with the men in yes. army, I don't know, in cinema, in movies,
yes. Yes.
in many kind of offices or places, even in universities.
All right.
When they display to the, let's say, to the men,
yes.
What are the
you
natural,
showing their bodies
yeah,
or
yeah.
Something
what
like
are the natural reaction of men?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you look at the statistics,
okay.
we naturally come to this conclusion that these ladies themselves, all particularly right. those who, for example, are like actress.
Yeah, in the cinema,
yeah, if you just,
industry,
just interview
yeah,
them,
yeah, in
that
industry,
how do,
right.
for example, people act
right. okay.
or react
yes.
when you, for example, display or show off yourself?
Uh-huh.
This is something natural that happens
all
because
right.
according to the physicians, when there are two men and women together in a place just talking, not having
right.
any kind of, let's say, sexual desires,
yeah.
there are not any kind of sexual kind of talk between
yes.
them, a very normal talk when there is
right.
between two strangers,
yes.
men and women,
okay.
they say that there are a kind of special kind of things that would physically
mm-hmm.
be produced in the brains of men and women.
That's right.
That actually
especially
motivate
the sexual sensual
exactly,
part of the brain
exactly.
that's
that
right,
motivate
okay.
them towards
right.
that kind of sexual desire
kind of irritating power that's
naturally
right.
yeah, it is proven if they
all
search
right.
they will find that the physicians, the doctors and also the psychologists are of this view
all right.
So that is why Islam says that you have to consider this nature
very good
yeah. That is why Islam says that if you ladies want to live very with dignity, with honor, with respect, you have to be careful. But of course, hijab is for men as well. Sometimes
uh-huh.
we only
very
think
good.
That hijab is only for women.
Yes.
No, because hijab is not only covering the body, physical aspect of hijab
mm-hmm.
is important, but the most important aspect of hijab is the intention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way you behave, what is your intention? Sometimes, for example, you may cover the entire body.
All right.
You even put, for example, what we can say, niqab or burqa.
A burqa
yeah?
on your face,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
right.
But the way you act,
uh-huh.
the way you speak,
yes.
Then of course everybody would understand.
Might be
exactly.
irritating, that's
exactly.
right.
Exactly.
And sexually, you know, more
exactly.
That's,
that's
right.
why
okay.
the intention is also important.
Very
the
good.
Mentality you have is also
right.
important. It's not only for women,
mm-hmm.
for men also, because men should also control their eyes.
Very good.
Control
right.
their tongue. Control,
mm-hmm.
you know, this kind of control men should also observe. So that's why we can say that we have hijab of eyes for men.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, men
good.
Should also observe this hijab.
Good.
Men should also observe the hijab of tongue.
That's right.
They should not speak. They should not talk to the ladies
right.
in a way that it motivates them or irritates them. That is why hijab is very, very deep kind of, or with different kind of layers.
That's right.
Yeah, there are some, the surface of these doctrines of Islam is this, that okay, physically we should cover, for example, our body.
All right.
But when you go deep, the deeper layer of hijab is the intention, the mentality, the beliefs, the way that you behave, all of these can be considered as a kind of hijab in Islam.
I could really remember it was a national team, I mean gymnastic, of the ladies in Germany who asked their federation in order to give them a kind of cloth that covers, we can say, top to toe, I mean from neck to toe, because they said that we are not sexual objects for the pleasure of the men who are watching the sports. I mean, and there are so many movements out in the Western world, even the ladies who are after the rights, Me Too or something like that. I'm not talking about the first steps that the women take in order to get into the industry through the nakedness or nudity or something like that. But nowadays, they could see the disadvantages of the nudity in the movies and the cinema industry. And the good news is that so many of the ladies in the Western world are selecting hijab as a way to getting back into tranquil, serene lifestyle, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. You find that many women, as you mentioned, choosing this kind of covering. Because according to the verse of Noble Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that ذَلِكَ أَدْنَا أَن يُعْرَفْنَا فَلَا يُؤْذَيْنَ. Part of the philosophy of hijab is to be covered and not to be disturbed by other people, and because of that, they want to maintain the family, they want to maintain the serenity, calmness, and because of that, they choose this concept of hijab. And as I said that, yes, thank to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, many women that have been choosing this, kind of covering because of this philosophy that we have been mentioned. They want to have their own family. That's they right. want to enjoy their life.
Okay.
Yes, and because of that.
And get back to the normal type of lifestyle.
Yeah.
That's
yes,
right.
Yeah.
Recently, there was a, we can say one of the big cases was the lifestyle of a former porn star, Ra-Lil Black. I mean, like the Japanese porn star who converted to Islam, we can say, deleted all her photos from Instagram, the nude pictures, and converted to Islam and started to, we can say, observe hijab.
Exactly.
And when she was asked why so, she said, I want to get back to the normal lifestyle, the spiritual lifestyle, and the respect that the ladies have in Islam is really, really important for me.
Exactly, my brother. I'm wondering that this nudity is not modernity.
That's right.
I don't know why people will confuse these two concepts.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, Shaykh Nur Muhammad and Shaykh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of hijab. It was very kind of you. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, please visit our website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
I know that you could easily take away everything you've given me, and I try to remember not to take anything for granted, 'cause I know that one day suddenly this will all come to an end. So my last wish is for you to be pleased with me.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Mahdi Rastani.
Tonight we want to delve into and learn from our first imam what it means to be compassionate, what it means to be kind, and have a master class on the compassion and the mercy of our beloved first imam. Sometimes people hear stories about our imams, whether it's the first imam or in also when it comes to the 12th imam and his reappearance, and one might assume mistakenly that this is a person who only cares about the law. If you were to go against him, if you were to make a mistake, that's it, it's over. So you hear, for example, they say about the 12th imam that if you don't follow the law, he will hold you accountable. And one might walk away having this off-putting picture of the imam, that this is a dry person, he's a rigid person, he's the person who only knows discipline and nothing else. And this couldn't be further from the picture of who the imam truly was. Yes, Ali followed the law and he was very specific about it when it came to the rights of others. There's no doubt about this. And hence when his friend came to him late at night and knocked on the door, Ali speaks about this in some of his khutbas. And he says, let me tell you about something astonishing. When someone gave me a bribe and wanted me to sell my akhirah for the dunya. He says, this is very astonishing that this person expected me to take him up on this offer. His friend came, knocked on the door late at night, gave him sweets. And he said, Ya Ali, this is for you. And Ali asked him, he said, what is this for? Is this under which category? Is this zakat? Is this, what type of wealth is this you're giving to me? Because if it's zakat, it's haram upon us. As a family of the Prophet, we don't take zakat. And this person turned to him and said, no, Ya Ali, innaha hadiyatun, it's a gift for you. But of course, a gift to the Khalifa of the time, yes, late at night, this is, of course, a set way or a gateway into bribing Ali. And so Ali says, I looked at this food and I told him, have you gone mad? Or are you possessed by jinn? Or are you hallucinating that you're expecting Ali to take this food and sell his dunya or sell his akhirah to his dunya? So Ali was very particular about this. He looked at the sweets. He said, these sweets look like the food that comes from the tree of hellfire. That's how I see it. Looks very beautiful to you. To me, it looks like the food that comes from the tree of zaqum. Doesn't look like the food that you look at. So Ali was very open about this. At the same time, there was a compassion in his heart that was unmatched. Hence you find the Prophet Muhammad al-Mustafa salawatullahi wasalamu alayhi. He He said about Ali, he said, Ya Ali, إن الله جعلك تحب المساكين. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given you a gift where you just love those who are in need. You love the less fortunate, you love the destitute. And this is why, Ya Ali, they are happy to follow you and they are happy to have you as an imam. This is the compassion of the imam. How did the imam used to show this compassion? This is number one. The first way that the imam used to show this compassion is that Imam Ali would never walk around and say, these are the laws of God, I'm done, I'll see you on the day of judgment. Either you follow it or you don't follow it, I'm gone. Part of the compassion of Ali was that he continuously interacted with the people of his time. Continuously tried to guide them. Continuously tried to remind them. The second level of the compassion of Ali is when he shows compassion and you see that he understands the mindset of the people he is dealing with. And he meets people where they are. This is the second level of his compassion. And you see this in the way that he used to deal with his young servant by the name of Qambar. This narration, narrated by Shia and by Sunni, Ahmad ibn Hanbal has narrated this in his book by the name of Fada'il al-Sahaba. It's a long book with many of the Fada'il of the Sahaba. And Ahmad ibn Hanbal, of course, the founder of the Hanbali school of thought, is well known to have said that the Fada'il we have heard about Ali, we have not heard about any other companion of the prophets. This is from him. Asqalani narrates this from him in Fathul Bari, fi sharh sahih al-Bukhari. Ahmad ibn Hanbal narrates, he says, Ali went out with his servant Qambar, and he has narrated a portion of this narration. He went out with his servant Qambar into the bazaar. He came to the place where they sell clothes and they sell cloth. He turned to the owner. He said, sell me some cloth. I need two shirts. Again, this person said, yes, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, I will do it for you. He walked away. He said, you know exactly who I am. He found another person. He said, will you sell it to me? Each for 3 dirhams. He said, yes. He sold him the two pieces of cloth, the clothing. He started to walk away. And then Ali took the one that was better. And he turned to Qambar. And he said, Qambar, wear this one. And the one that wasn't so appealing, he started to wear it himself. And Qambar turned to Ali. He said, Ya Ali, my master, but you go up on the minbar and you speak and you do this, people see your clothing a lot more than they see my clothing. You're supposed to take the better one. And Ali said, yes, but you know what it is? I'm embarrassed to dress better than you. This was his servant. He said, I'm embarrassed to dress better than you. And the other thing is that you are young. And because you're young, you have these aspirations and hopes and dreams. I'm older. I can live a simpler lifestyle. You're young. You like to look good. You like to look nice, so on and so forth. He gave him that piece of clothing. Recite a salawat, please. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. He turned to Qambar. He said, this one is for you because you have sharahu shabab. You have that fire in you that when you're young, you want to present yourself in a certain way. You want to dress a certain way. And Ali, you see the flexibility that he has with Qambar. And this is something our parents need to learn from. Because there are times where our younger generation, because they come from a different time, because they come from a different place, they come from a different culture, they will ask for things that may not necessarily make the most sense to you. And what you have to look at is, number one, is this haram? No one is asking you to compromise on haram. If it's haram, you look at them and you say, no, we don't do this. This is haram. Oh, you know, sometimes people say, oh, but the times have changed. If the times had changed, then the rules of Islam already have changed based on the times as well. Don't try to change the rules of Islam because the times have changed. This is already built into the faith. But if it's haram, it's haram. You don't compromise on it. You don't have to compromise on it. And I tell you, your children will respect you more if you don't compromise on it. This is haram, number one. Number two, if it's a really bad decision, it's going to affect their life very heavily in a negative way. Yes, you're the father, you're the mother, this is your role. You're supposed to be their eyes for things that they may not be able to see. Smaller things, it's okay. Bigger things, no, this is part of your role. You're supposed to stand there and say, no, listen, I'm telling you, this is going to ruin things. This is a serious issue. And it may not necessarily in every situation be haram. That's why I'm mentioning it as a second category. But if it's going to have a negative impact and it's something big, it's a big decision, you're supposed to make that clear to them. It's part of your role. And it's okay for you to go back to them multiple times. Listen, I told you this is not a good idea. This is how Ali used to do things as well. But then it comes down to smaller things. It's not haram. It's not ideal from your perspective. But he wants to do it like this. Allah, he wants his hair to look like this. You can tell him, listen, you look weird, but he's not going to buy it from you. That's okay. And Ali will tell you, you know what? He has sharahu shabab. He's young. He wants to do things in a certain way. It's okay. You let him do things in a certain way. This constant fine balance between making your point clear to your child and at the same time having that flexibility is a very difficult thing. It's a very difficult thing. Where do I get harsh and I say, no, this is it, and you put your foot down? And where do I play with it and I'm flexible with it? I'm not saying this is easy. This is very difficult. This is part of your reward as a father or a mother. But this is what Ali taught us.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareemun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners special.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warmest greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special Program on this Sunday, April 6, 2025. I'm Atefa Irfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special Program is the Sunday program where your views are presented through your emails, letters, and messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcasts. And if you have any message for our listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Remember, Listeners Special Program is your program. It's your views that are important. Welcome back. This is Listeners, a special program, and as usual, we've received reception reports and emails from around the world, and in this edition of Listeners, a special program, we will read emails from Reginaldo Anunciação, one of our old and regular listeners from Brazil, as well as an email from Sweden from Lillian Mull. And in this edition of Listeners, a special program, we will talk about Maranjab Desert as a tourist attraction in Iran. Maranjab Desert is one of the most popular desert attractions in Iran and Isfahan province. It is just a short distance from Tehran and is located near Aran and Bitgol. The attractions of nature and tourism include sandy hills and rams, Abbasid Caravanserai, and the Wandering Island. Also, it is one of the astronomy sites in Iran. After a short break, I will talk about Maranjab Desert more. Stay with us, please. The Salt Lake of Maranjab, with dozens of tourist attractions, was registered in Iran's heritage list. This lake, which is located in the central desert of Iran between Isfahan, Semnan, and Qom provinces, with a length of 80 kilometers and a width of 30 kilometers, is about 795 meters above the sea level and is the largest salt lake in Iran. The Salt Lake is located 48 kilometers northeast of Aran and Bitgol city and is bounded on the east of Sefidab and Siyahkuh Mountains, a national park of the desert, on the north and west of Masila Desert, and on the south by the Maranjab Desert and Banderig. The lake is covered with salt deposits that have formed over the centuries as floods and surface water have accumulated, and the lake's salt depth varies between 5 and 54 meters square, separated by layers of clay. Sargardan Island is one of the most scenic parts of the lake, and the most important ingredients of this lake are sodium chloride, sodium sulfate, and more than 90,000 tons of salt is extracted from this lake annually. It is also called Wandering Island in English language. Welcome back. Dear listeners, Iran's deserts have beautiful and untouched attractions. These deserts are extremely beautiful, quiet, mysterious, and dignified. Deserts are among the world's most dramatically seductive natural habitats. In Iran's deserts, spotted diverse animal life can be spotted, including insects and wild animals, with a rich variety of spectacular desert landforms. The desert, Sahara, Kavir, or Kalut are scientifically different, and their differentiations depend on altitude, annual precipitation, the type of vegetation, amount of salt present in the soil, and natural formations. In Iran, there are all types of deserts whose sand dunes, salt rivers, salt lakes, desert plants, birds, and wildlife attract thousands of tourists, depending on the regional and climatic conditions. This is listeners' special program, and let's see what our old and regular listener from Brazil, Reginaldo Anancioso, says. Reginaldo says, "Hello, how are you, dear sirs or madams? Well, I listen to your programs on SWs. I listen to IRIB English radio programs since, and yes, 80s. I think it means 1980s. Thank you very much for your attention. Also, please, I would like some material EQSL from Iran. Thank you very much. First of all, salam and warm greetings to Reginaldo Anunciaso from Brazil. Thank you very much for this email. Please accept our electronic QSL as confirmation to this email. And many thanks for your attention. Many thanks for your support, Reginaldo from Brazil. We wish you all the best